is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to Non-Commercial Community Radio, KBOO, Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Hello, KBOO listeners. Come join us at the station Friday, November 1st for KBOO's Dia de los Muertos First Friday Arts Walk from 5 to 9 p.m. We'll have local art, music, food, vendors, station tours, and more. This will be an event to remember. We can't wait to see you there.
Hello, my name is TK Kapurai and I'm an immigrant from Zimbabwe. I'm the host of The Global Cell, which airs live in the air room the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. I host immigrants and refugees from various global spots. I like to bring out their lived experiences so the world can know something about them. I like to bring a lot through my guests so we may have diverse experiences, cultures, foods, music, interests, and anything on the platform. We can share and learn a lot through their live instructions. Let's do this together, not only for a better platform for our community, but a better community for our platform. Again, tune in for my show, The Global Cell, live in the air room, the first Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and also available on the web at kboo.fm.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
This episode of Running on Air is a special rebroadcast that was taped live in the KBOO studio on Thursday, September 9th, 2024. Dates and events mentioned by the candidates may have already occurred. You can study up for this election by listening to all of our episodes of Running on Air on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/runningonair, or wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
Welcome to the first installment of District 4's version of Running on Air. I'm Barbara Bernstein, going to be your host for the next hour, and I'm here with three prospective city council candidates. We have with us Chad Likens, Lisa Friedman, and Andre Vladovin, who are all running for District 4, and we're going to learn a little bit more about why they're running and how we can all work together to make our city a better place. There's been a lot of talk for the last year about how we have this new city government that's going to be getting in place this January, and a whole new way of electing our city council candidates. So I wondered, start by having each one of you talk about why this new method of election and this new form of government has enticed you to run for office. And we'll start with Lisa.
Sure. Thank you so much, Barbara. Yeah, I mean, it really is charter reform and a transition to a new form of government that inspired me to join the race. I worked for the city of Portland for a little over 2 years. It was a great experience. I also got a front row seat to some of the dysfunction of our current form of government. So being able to see how helpful the changes are going to be. And also, before I worked for the city of Portland, I spent a decade working on supporting government transitions overseas in over a dozen countries, building confidence in new political systems in places like Afghanistan and Nigeria and Syria. And, you know, after Trump was elected is when I decided to shift my career locally, seeing that there's a lot of work to be done here on democracy, stability, and peace. And this is my moment to contribute to a political transition in the place where I live. And so I couldn't pass that up.
How much more difficult do you think it is to do a transition here in Portland than it was in Afghanistan?
It's going to be way easier.
We hope, anyway.
I mean, there will still be challenges, of course, and a lot of the challenges are similar, but obviously it's a much different situation here. Not having active violence on the streets or bombs dropping is going to be a big asset.
And the Proud Boys aren't quite as visible now as they were 10 years ago, so that maybe helps too. Andre, how about you?
Yeah, so I really enjoy these liminal spaces where we're moving from one form of government to the next, and so I also read the book All We Can Save, which is a series of climate essays by women and non-binary people on the front lines of climate issues. And one of the things that really struck me about that book was they really pushed for local changes, because if everyone is working toward local change, then we can all make global change. And so I started getting really involved in Portland's climate issues, especially the critical energy infrastructure hub and all of the earthquake risks there. I've been involved with 350 PDX and Extinction Rebellion PDX. And I was actually at a Braided River documentary film when they said, hey, by the way, all 12 city council seats are up for grabs. So if you're serious about that, let us know. And I, in fact, did send the organizers an email. And I'm like, hey, so about that, like, how do I do that? And no one got back to me. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to figure this out on my own. But I'm really, really excited about the possibility of getting a more intergenerational council, a council that is prepared to face the modern changes that we're experiencing, and a council that is really up to speed about all of the climate issues that are incoming.
And how about you, Chad?
Yeah, this is the most interesting local election happening in the nation right now. And for Portland, it gives us this narrow window of opportunity to have a serious response to the big problems we have. Top of mind is housing affordability and homelessness. It's not the only issue, but for every issue I care about, like climate change, safety, addiction, all these other things, it is the unlock for every issue.
And explain that. What do you mean by that?
So I don't know a city that is safe that has 5,900 people sleeping unsheltered. It's not safe for the people that are unsheltered, I mean, first and foremost, but also for other folks, and it doesn't feel safe. I think that when it comes to climate, the two things that have the biggest impact are certainly transportation and how we build buildings and where we build buildings. So as we're responding to this crisis in housing affordability, we have to think about where are we going to put those buildings, what are they going to look like. So that's why I've been a big supporter of the Inner East Side for All project that was championed by Portland Neighbors Welcome. They made their first big win in City Hall recently to have this studied. And in general, I favor upzoning and protections for renters, legal representation. We're just in a major moment here as a city where we have to decide, are we going to be a place that's affordable for teachers and firefighters and grocery store workers and all those folks? So we only have two levers to pull. We can either try to make housing cheaper, or we can try to raise wages. And we have to do a little bit of both.
Well, Chad, in your early publicity, the first thing I saw was that you're really into chess. And I'm kind of curious about that. And when I first met you, which was maybe like 6 months ago, we were walking through the back end of the CEI hub behind Linton. So I want to see how those two things go together in your reality of how you would approach working for the city.
Yeah, so I got my PhD in leadership and policy from Vanderbilt, and went to the University of Hong Kong and specialized in out-of-school learning for kids. And I did a project for the Asian Development Bank, and I got to do some research capacity building in Cambodia so that they could look at their education system there and see what was happening during the school day and what was happening after the school day. When I came to Portland, I saw that we actually had some pretty big gaps here in our schools, that there were kids that didn't have access to after-school programs, and PPS often made it really hard to start something up. So I started at one school. Now we have 10 employees at about 20 different schools, and it was chess. And it just started because I always kind of liked it, and my kids liked it, but they were going to shut down the chess program at our school. So I ended up hiring a grandmaster and taking lots of lessons and getting to be fairly competent at it. And then we won a state championship, and as kids surpassed me, then you know we would pass them on to stronger coaches. But we wanted to build a different kind of community than we see in other states. In Oregon, when I became president of the statewide nonprofit that governs chess, it was 92% male. And so in 2 years, I launched something called the Oregon Chess Project, and we raised female participation by about 700%. And we built this little community, and now we've probably served about 1,000 families that are inside District 4. And so when I'm knocking doors, I see my students every day. And it's just really great, and we're kind of coming together to try to get representation in City Hall.
So what's the connection between teaching kids to know how to play chess and dealing with the horrors that we face with the CEI hub and Zenith Energy and all those other things that are going on in the north reach of the Willamette River?
Yeah, so I actually don't use chess metaphors very often for politics because chess is a game of perfect information, and the real world isn't like that. But there are some things that are similar. There's the idea of humility and being able to learn from other people. And if you've been crushed by a fourth grader at chess, you learn that. It's mainly about serving people. I think it's not necessarily chess. It could have been tennis or pickleball or, you know, whatever it is that gives people a healthy thing to do after school, track. I think that creating opportunities for kids and the way you do it, you know, providing scholarships so that you never have to turn away somebody because they can't afford to pay, that's the kind of community building that every community should strive for.
But when I was puzzling out your thing with chess when I first learned about it and thinking it seemed so superficial, and then I remembered I used to work with kids many, many years ago, and we played a lot of chess, and I would have my pants whipped off me by these fourth graders. But it gave me a sense of there's a way that you have to think in chess, and yeah. I wonder how that relates to the way you have to think when you're in government.
I do think that Portland has struggled to think one move ahead. And in chess, a lot of people think that the strongest players think several moves ahead, and they do a little bit, but that raw computation is just a very small part. Most of it's pattern recognition. If you're a novice, you're mostly computing and doing, because you don't have the patterns in your head, a little bit like a musician. You can't batch information, but the strongest players can look at it and sort of recognize the patterns there. And I think that my policy training and my PhD there means I have a lot of patterns in my head, and I can kind of see how evidence could be used on this specific policy issue. But yeah, thinking ahead.
Well, we're going to use this chess metaphor for everybody else for a little while. So, Lisa, how do you see the role that chess would play in running the government here in Portland?
Well, I'm definitely one of those people who gets beat by my kids in chess. So I'm not going to rely on any chess expertise, but I have spent a career working in complex environments on complex problems in situations where, you know, it's dynamic. Things are changing fast, and the problems are hard to understand until you start getting in there and interacting with the problems. And that's one thing that I think is going to be really critical. You know, here in Portland, we are facing a lot of really complex problems. There are no silver bullets. There's not one answer that one study can tell us, like, this is what you do. And we're going to be building confidence in a new government system. We're going to be addressing a climate emergency. We're going to be addressing a housing emergency. We're going to be addressing public safety issues. And the key that I've learned from working in complex environments is it's better to be 80% right at the right time than 100% right too late. And you have to be willing to get in there and just do something, interact with the problem, and then also learn from that interaction so you can iterate and make your interventions better. And I think that's a really important way that governments need to interact when they're facing these really tough issues.
It seems to me that the way the Portland government's been working, particularly for the last 2 years, but probably for about the last 6 or 7 years, was that it's like running away from the problems. And it's been very frustrating. And I think there have been some really good problem solvers on city council when they got unelected and by some forces that we're going to talk about in a little bit that are particularly focused in District 4. We know the business community. So I wonder how we basically kind of reset ourselves in the city to be able to take on these serious problems, and wondering if this new form of government will actually be helpful.
Absolutely. I mean, this is exactly what we need in order to make progress on solving our most pressing challenges. And on one hand, we're going to have a city administrator, commissioners not running bureaus anymore. That's going to encourage efficiency and collaboration and coordination that there's just no system or structure for in the current form.
Also, it depoliticizes and depersonalizes them. Because there was one case that I sort of always liked Portland's form of government. It seems so funky, and I like to believe I lived in a small town, which is what it is, a small town government. But I was very disconcerted when a person who was the head of one of the departments got axed by the city councilor and city commissioner who was in charge of that department. And it was a personality issue. And it gave me a real insight into why this is not a good form of government. I wonder if getting this, taking it away from the interpersonality issues that can happen, that we can have a cleaner kind of government.
Absolutely. And I, you know, I can illustrate this from my experience working in the city in the Community Safety Division. And the Community Safety Division was created to try to anticipate charter reform happening and this change, and to build more coordination and collaboration within our public safety system, which is great. And it has been successful and kind of looked at as an example for the rest of our service areas going forward. But I walked in and we're looking at what does it take to keep a community safe. And you have the police bureau reports to the mayor, 911 reports to this commissioner, the fire department reports to a different commissioner, and the buck stops with them. How do you have a system that can look holistically to say, what can we do to keep us safe when everything is so siloed and the incentives are to protect and preserve the system? And so breaking that open and being able to, yeah, depoliticize, depersonalize, but also build that system view rather than a bureau view is going to be so critical to so many of our problems.
Andra, I want to talk a little bit about your whole approach to this campaign, because you are, both Lisa and Chad are running more or less traditional campaigns, like they're raising money, they have lawn signs, things like that. Let's talk about your approach and why you've taken that approach.
Yeah, so when I looked at running my campaign, I sat down with myself and I said, okay, what do I want my campaign to look like and how much does that want to cost? And I didn't want to do yard signs because I don't want to create plastic waste that's going to end up in the landfill. I didn't want to do a whole bunch of printing. I think running as a very climate-oriented candidate, it was really important to me to not put more burden on the environment. And at a lot of the forums that I go to, there's a stack that is several inches thick of materials that candidates leave behind. And I didn't want that to be part of my image. And so if I'm not printing and I don't want to be funding digital ads that are taking Portland money out of Portland and giving it to big tech companies, and I don't want to be really doing anything that I don't have some oversight over. So I'm running my own social media campaigns, and I'm not a person who can really afford a campaign manager or a treasurer. So I went ahead and I'm very lucky to have subsidized housing right now. And so I took time off work and I said, okay, I'll be my own campaign manager. I'll be my own treasurer. I'll read all the campaign law. I'll go to all of these forums. I'll volunteer in the community. And as I was doing that, I was also asking a lot of the people in my community, like, how would you want your perfect candidate to meet you? How would you like that interaction to go? What place would you like that to happen at? And they're like, honestly, I ignore everything until the voter pamphlet comes out. And what I really realized is that not every county has a voter pamphlet. And it's one of the most democratic things that we have, because you can't pay to have more words like you can in newspapers, like you can on some ad platforms. And so I was really just looking at how do I be someone in the community who people can look up to? How can I be someone in the community who is actually doing good and not just being out there and trying to get my name out there? Because I ultimately want to feel like I am running an ethical campaign, and I want to feel like I am completely maintaining my own integrity through this whole process. And so really looking at what I wanted to spend money on, it was less than $1,000, because I needed a website, I needed the web hosting, and I needed to pay for the voter pamphlet submission, and then traveling to events. And I'm taking the bus most of the time. And so it really came out to less than even the lowest tier matching with the small donor election program. And so I thought, I'm not going to ask for money. I know that my voter base is mostly poor, mostly queer, people struggling with rent. I don't want them to have to choose between donating to a candidate and paying for lunch. So instead, I've been funneling a lot of, when people ask if they can give me a donation, I've been funneling that to local charity groups.
And you're listening to Running on Air, which is a special KBOO miniseries that we're running for the election. I'm Barbara Bernstein, and we are here on our daily radio roundtable conversation with people running to represent Portland. And in this episode, we're talking to three candidates from District 4, which is the West Side plus Selwood. And we can talk a little bit about why that is. Anyway, and so we're talking today with Andra Vladivin, who we just heard from, Lisa Friedman, and Chad Likens. We want you to join the conversation. You can call the Air Room with questions for candidates at 503-231-8187. You can message a question on the website, kboo.fm, and you can also email us your questions at runningonair@kboo.org. So let's talk a little bit about this district that we're all in. Actually, it's my district as well, which is why I decided to host District 4 panels. It is an odd district, and it's the district that traditionally all the power, political power in Portland has been concentrated in, except not so. But the other part about it is when you look at what the West Side is, the West Side's a very broad reach. It ranges from the most expensive homes in Portland in the West Hills to Linton. And actually, there's some rather low-income communities in Southwest Portland as well, which my friends in Southwest Portland keep wanting to remind me of that. So I wanted to talk about some of the challenges of running in this district and how to – well, it's interesting to me, actually, going back 6 months when I first saw the list of candidates and I met Chad, and there was this other guy, Moses, who was head of the Multnomah Neighborhood Association. And other than that, it sounded like downtown Portland business as usual. Things have really changed, and I haven't decided who I'm voting for yet because there's so many good candidates. But let's talk about two things. First of all, how do we make sure that the other voices besides the business community are represented from District 4? And how do we not dilute the vote, the progressive vote? So I'm going to start with Chad.
Oh, that's a really good question. There's 33 neighborhoods in this district, and representing all of them takes a lot of energy, and you have to be proactive about it. I've canvassed in all 33 neighborhoods. We've knocked over 8,000 doors so far, with me personally knocking over 5,000 of those. We've also tried to make sure that our campaign team represents the entire district. We had close to 30 summer fellows working for the campaign this summer, and we recruited them primarily from Lincoln and Wells and Cleveland high schools. Those are the schools where students from District 4 go to, plus some college age folks from PSU and elsewhere. And being able to walk their neighborhoods with them and hear about their issues was really important. You know, for instance, yesterday I was in Lair Hill, and there's a truly spectacular pothole where it's on an intersection where people turn right, and people have to that are coming up, they'll have to go left, and so it's just a very dangerous spot, and there'll probably be an accident there. You wouldn't know that unless you had walked that neighborhood and known that that's the number one thing for them. And then they were able to walk me through all the hurdles they've had to go to and why the city won't fill it for them. The history goes back 150 years to when Lair Hill was incorporated into Portland, and there's still this old argument as to who owns the road. But again, you don't know it unless you show up for your community. We also, the kind of campaign you run and where your money comes from shows a lot about you. I'm really proud that we have the most donations under $25 of any of the 28 or 29 candidates in this district. Even with that, with such small donations, we're able to be very competitive. We're up in the top tier with fundraising, which is going to help us reach more people, pay something approximating a living wage to our field director and to our campaign manager.
I'm kind of curious how your fundraising compares to, to the some of your opponents who are more representative of the downtown business community.
I think that the big difference is not going to come. So we're ahead of most of them, almost all of them. Which is pretty exciting because there's a $350 cap on how much you can donate, so they can't go collect the $5,000 and $10,000 checks directly. That said, independent expenditures are going to be a big part of this campaign, and we knew going into this that outside groups could come in and spend four or five or 10 times as much as we are going to raise, but they can't outwork us. And so I'm pretty sure that we can push back on any kind of dirty stuff that happens due to outside groups coming in.
So how does that fit with your view, Andra?
Yeah, so I think that we really need to talk about ranked choice voting in all of this, because it's a completely new voting system and we have never done it before. And there's not the same amount of statistics around how this plays out in practice. And so I think we really have an opportunity with being able to vote for up to six of really saying that, okay, these are the people that I really believe that are going to push forward Portland's values. And so I'm really excited to see how that part of this plays out. And ranked choice voting is, I think, the reason why a candidate like me can run, because, you know, otherwise it's all about the money. How much have you raised? And even still, I find that it's a lot about the money. Even really progressive endorsements will not come through if you don't meet your first donor matching threshold through the Small Donor Elections Program. So I think there's still a lot to change on that front. But overall, I'm feeling optimistic, and I think that when you're looking at candidates and who you might want to vote for, a really popular catchphrase right now is revitalizing downtown. And I would really, really suggest that you ask hard questions about what that means to each candidate.
We're going to have them on next week.
Right. So if you hear that phrase, I would really, really drill down and ask them what that means, because a lot of times that's a pretty big indication in that they're interested in promoting business interests. And I think that we as a community deserve better than that. I think that we need to look at revitalizing downtown as making sure that people are happy to be here, that people feel like they can participate in their government, and that they feel heard by their local leaders who are tackling the crises that we're facing.
Well, Lisa, I'm kind of curious about your relationship to the district. Your first big event is actually happening, you say so, but it's actually Westmoreland. What the watershed is.
Okay.
Just as a Selwood resident, we distinguish this, actually, like all these different little neighborhoods within what's Selwood. But I'm curious about your focusing on my neighborhood mm-hmm. as a start, mm-hmm. which is not seen as part of the Portland business power base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'll just start from, you know, when we look at the amazing thing we did when we voted for charter reform, district representation is a game changer. And the fact that we've never had this before in Portland is wild. Whatever you think of our current council, the ability to represent the entire city while also managing city bureaus is an impossible job. And we're going to flip that on its head, having, you know, one area of the city getting three people to represent it. And when it comes to representing all the different interests within any district, but District 4, which, as you mentioned, is very diverse in terms of having downtown, Linton, the CEI hub, a lot of educational institutions, the East Side, the only district across the river, having those three representatives to be able to engage the many different interests rather than just hearing the loudest voices is going to be so critical. And I know that, you know, the shorthand for District 4 is the West Side, and then often people will tag on, and also neighborhoods in the Inner East Side. And I know that there is anxiety within Selwood and East and Westmoreland about being included in District 4 and being overshadowed by the rest of the district and the West Side, and particularly probably downtown. And as someone who lives in Multnomah Village and Southwest neighborhoods, I think we have a lot in common with the East Side neighborhoods that are in District 4, and I'm personally thrilled that those neighborhoods are also in my district. And that's one of the reasons that I'm having my field launch in Eastmoreland.
No, Westmoreland.
Apologies. So I still have learning to do. But I just want to make clear that those voices are going to matter, and they're going to be a valuable part of District 4 and representing District 4.
Well, it's interesting that you're from Multnomah Village, which I feel is another neighborhood very much like Selwood, only it has fewer sidewalks.
A lot fewer sidewalks.
Yeah, but you have a lot of nice natural areas and a really nice little business district. It's a village, and Selwood is actually two villages. It was Westmoreland and Selwood. But I wonder how that stands up to the business interests, and how do you organize so that the voices that you're trying to represent are going to be heard along with the business district?
I mean, that's up to us. That's up to who we elect. And one of the approaches that I take, and I take this from my work overseas, engaging marginalized communities, communities that have distrust in government, communities that are traditionally overlooked by government, is in every conversation, you think, who's missing from this conversation? Whose voice is being privileged in this conversation? What extra work do I have to do in order to get the voices that are not here right now into this conversation? And that takes work, especially when you're dealing with communities that do not feel like they have a voice in government, don't trust, don't have the time to go to a city city council meeting in the middle of the day. That takes a lot of extra outreach to build that trust. And it really, again, comes down to who we elect. Are they going to be able to and have the will to put in that effort to engage the communities outside of the ones that are going to be knocking on the doors of City Hall?
Well, one of the things I've heard in other cities as well as Portland about the importance of having neighborhood meetings, community meetings that are in the neighborhoods and that are in the evenings and that provide childcare. Do you see, is that one of the things that you might be running on?
Absolutely. We need to have a lot of different options for people to participate. And it can't just be during the day, come downtown. So having multiple times of day, reducing barriers for participation, like providing childcare, all of this is part of the solution to getting more voices, providing materials in people's native languages, providing accessibility options, providing surveys that people can do in their homes so they don't have to necessarily show up to a two-hour meeting. There's so many things that we can do and that we will need to do, and we're hiring an engagement officer at the City of Portland for the first time. So I look forward to working with the engagement officer once they're hired to develop an equitable engagement framework so we can make sure that we're incorporating all those voices in a way that involves best practices for outreach and engagement. This is a field of study that we can rely on.
And you're listening to Running on Air. It's a daily radio roundtable conversation that KBOO is producing for the next few weeks about the election. It's with people running to represent Portland. And in this episode, we're talking with candidates from District 4, and we're hearing from Chad Likens, Lisa Friedman, and Andra Bolotovin. So we're going to take a little musical break, and then we'll be back with more questions for our candidates.
This episode of Running on Air is a special rebroadcast that was taped live in the KBOO studio on Thursday, September 9th, 2024. Dates and events mentioned by the candidates may have already occurred. You can study up for this election by listening to all of our episodes of Running on Air on the KBOO website, kboo.fm, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for Running on Air comes from KBOO members and the League of Women Voters. More information about the candidates on your ballot can be found at the League of Women Voters of Portland's website, lwvpdx.org. The League has videos of candidate interviews and forums, as well as links to candidates' written answers to questions and explanations of ballot measures. That's lwvpdx.org, providing nonpartisan voter information. And we're back with our panel of District 4 candidates for Portland City Council, and we are talking today with Chad Likens, Lisa Friedman, and Andra Bolotovin, whose name I've been mispronouncing for the first half hour, so I will try to get it right for the second half hour. So let's talk a little bit about issues. KBOO did a survey to find out what voters, at least what our listeners who were voting, are most concerned with, and the biggest one was climate. And then a subtext to that is the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub and Zenith Energy, which you've heard a lot about on this station for the last couple of years now. So let's talk about that. And then actually, right after that was homelessness. And I really am interested, Chad, in your links between the climate and homelessness, especially on a day like today and tomorrow are going to be what it's like to be homeless when it's 98 degrees mm-hmm. out. So let's start by talking about, actually, let's try linking the two issues and seeing how these, because these probably are the two biggest issues that are facing Portland. And each one, of course, opens up a whole Pandora's box of other issues and concerns. So I'll start with Chad.
Yeah, I mean, we're at the point now where we're talking about climate justice and climate resilience. Carbon reduction is part of it, but we know that the harms of climate change are going to fall disproportionately on Black and brown communities and on our lower-income communities and our houseless communities. I got to take a project tour recently of four different sites that have been funded by the Portland Clean Energy Community Benefits Fund, or PCEF, and one of them was the Street Roots headquarters. They have to deliver a higher level of services than they have had to deliver ever in the past with forest fires and the smoke blowing into Portland. The air is not healthy to breathe at certain moments in the summer. It's so hot that people need services. I want to talk about what this means and how we should have a compassionate response to people who are unhoused and compare it to a place like Grants Pass. So Grants Pass has chosen something called sanctioned camping or designated camping, where you round up every person in their tent and the police frog march them into a gravel or paved space and put a barbed wire fence around it. That's what they're doing. That will move zero people to permanent housing. And it's like 102 degrees. They're actually discouraging people from making donations there even. And there's no services attached. We know that doesn't work.
Why are they discouraging people from making donations? And who's they? The city?
Yeah, the city. And I think the idea is that it enables people. It's really wrongheaded. What we know about homelessness is that if we give people a room with a door that locks, and it's a good room, it's insulated, it has access to air conditioning, and if you give them the services they need, whether it's mental health care, drug counseling, job training, peer support, those are propelling people to permanent housing at four times the rate of anything the city had ever tried before. And we tried every bad idea. And so now we're all out of bad ideas. And so we had to try some good ideas. Congregate shelters were basically a policy failure. You know, asking an elderly person or a queer person to sleep in a room next to, you know, five other people that are going through withdrawal or having psychosis, people leave within hours. And then it's really hard to re-earn their trust that the system's looking out for their welfare. I do think these things are related, and I think that when we're deciding about what kind of shelters we should build, we should be thinking about climate along with it.
Well, let's talk a bit more about climate. This is something where Portland has seen itself as a leader for over 10 years, 14 years. However, I think that the leadership qualities have really deteriorated and evaporated in the last 6 or 7 years. So what do you see that Portland needs to do to really take meaningful steps to address the climate issue?
The biggest sources of carbon emissions in Portland are transportation and buildings. So we need to keep focused on the really big things and not try to win every little battle, because we got to win the big ones. For transportation, it's going to really come down to, are we going to be a multimodal city? When they do surveys of Portlanders, I think it was 67% of them said that they would walk or ride a bike or take public transit if it felt safe and effective to do so. And we have to now do some things that maybe aren't as great for the politician, because you don't get to cut a ribbon, but they're great for the people that you're serving. So for instance, buses. We're going to have to make some decisions between electrifying buses, which is very expensive, or increasing frequency and reliability, which is also very expensive. If you're the person trying to get to work and you're deciding, can I take a bus or do I need to go invest in a car, it's the frequency and reliability. And that's going to be where we have the first carbon reduction. So those are the things that we prioritize.
Yeah, actually, as somebody who lives in an area that's underserved by Sellwood, Sellwood is underserved by TriMet, and it's discouraging. And actually, they cut the bus line that goes by my house. It now has been moved four blocks away. So it seems that now TriMet is not the city of Portland, but I wonder if there's a way that the city of Portland can work more closely with TriMet to actually increase reliability and frequency. I'll throw that out to Lisa.
Yeah, and this is something, well, first of all, I want to say that I'm so delighted that your listeners named climate as the number one issue.
We I feel like really it rarely, great listeners.
It rarely actually comes up as the number one issue in a lot of forums and other surveys, but it's probably our most pressing issue for surviving as a city. I'm kind of sad that Andrew didn't get to answer this question first. But when we're talking about bus lines, for example, you know, the Rose Line project was something that started before COVID, where the city of Portland had a partnership with TriMet to develop these dedicated bus lanes. And then COVID happened and so many things got thrown for a loop during COVID. And so that partnership kind of fell off. The city kept working on the dedicated bus lines, but it is time now that we're, you know, getting back into a groove a bit to bring TriMet back to the table to talk about increasing the frequency of those bus lines, because people are going to use them, like Chad said, when they're easy to use and they get you where you want to go.
Another issue is that TriMet should be free. I mean, I should not pose that as, that's not a question, but it's definitely an issue that's been on the table. And actually, I'll have Andrew, why don't you address that?
Yeah, so I actually helped with the activist groups. OPAL was involved, Extinction Rebellion was involved, 350 was involved to advocate for fareless transit. And there are many other cities who are surpassing us as environmental leaders who have implemented fareless transit. And so I definitely think that that's something that should be on the table. And that's going to require collaborating with Metro and TriMet and the other government agencies in the city. Metro is really interesting because I believe it's the only style of regional government of its like in the nation. And so it gives Portland a unique challenge because we have yet another government agency that we need to all be collaborating with. But to go back to your question about how climate issues relate with the unhoused community, I do think that Portland as a whole really needs to think about the downstream effects of all of their choices. And, you know, the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub, the CEI Hub, is one such thing. We didn't do the necessary research when those facilities were built to understand the earthquake risk, the fault lines, the chemicals that are being leached into the soil, the liquefaction risks. And now that we know them, there's not enough being done. And similarly, with the crisis of the unhoused community, I think that we're trying to make quick fixes right now. The city council is trying to change the numbers, make it look like there are fewer people on the streets to get votes and the like. But the problem with that is right now there's things like, okay, we're going to incentivize businesses to offer hotel rooms to the in-house community, which sounds like it would be good, but it's weirdly incentivizing existing low-income housing units to translate into hotel rooms, kicking out the existing services and the people who are currently living there. So it's actually exacerbating the crisis. And I assume the best intentions. I assume that people are coming in, you know, with good intentions, but you have to look at the impacts. And so I've been talking with the nonprofit directors who are kind of filling the gaps in services with the unhoused population, and they're saying, you as a city councilor need to help people understand it's going to take time to solve these problems at a root cause level. And we can't be approaching this with one size fits all solutions. What works for one person does not work for the next person. And so we really need to have something like a case management system where we're asking the individual people, whether they're experiencing mental illness, whether they're experiencing houselessness, whether they're experiencing drug addiction, what is it that you want? What does recovery look like to you? Rather than assuming that we know, coming up with solutions, and then waiting several years to find out that they don't work.
Well, I want to talk about the Tyrannosaurus in the room, which is a CEI hub, which is something that the city council has really never taken on. I wonder, starting with Chad, who I met on a tour of the CEI hub, how, if you're on the city council and if the three of you are on the city council and there's another nine people who share your vision and your values, how do we take on the CEI hub as something that should no longer exist, basically?
Yeah. We have to do a couple things as quickly as possible, and then also think about like the medium to long term. Quickly, we need to figure out how to force them to have some kind of risk bonding so that we can get out of the situation we have right now, where basically they're able to internalize all profits and externalize all risk. If you could do that with every business venture, well, you know, why not do it? Why? There's no incentive to change anything. Figuring out how many of those units can be decommissioned because they're not even holding any fuel right now would be good. It'd be great to reclaim some land. And then the most important thing is, like, there's pretty much broad agreement all across the ideological spectrum that this is not the right place to be storing 90% of the state's fuels. It's not good for resilience. It's not good, you know, to have our two jewels of the Willamette River and Forest Park under such constant threat. But we don't know how much it would cost to move, and we don't have any good ideas as to where to move it. And we don't just want to give another smaller, less politically powerful community our problems. So I think this is something probably best funded at the state level, this kind of study, and we need to initiate it right now. The city has lobbyists, several of them, that go to Salem and make asks. And they can ask for anything we want, but they can't ask for everything we want. So it'll be up to us to sort of form a climate caucus and to send them with marching orders to say that we want a clear answer as to how much it would cost to move this and where it should go.
And you're listening to Running on Air. a daily radio roundtable conversation we're having on KABU for the next few weeks with people running to represent Portland. Today we're talking with candidates from District 4, including Chad Likens, who you just heard from, Lisa Friedman, and Andra Valtavine, and we're talking about the CEI Hub. If you want to join the conversation, you can call the air room with questions for candidates at 503-231-8187. You can message a question on the website, kbo.fm, and you can also email us your questions at runningonair@kbu.org. So, Andra, let's take up from where Chad left off.
Yeah, so addressing the issues of the CEI Hub require commitments from the city, from the county, from Metro, from the state, and from the federal government, and all of the stakeholders that are involved in that region. So it's going to be a major game of chess to bring that back in. So, but the really exciting thing is that Multnomah County is already planning to implement risk bonding with the CEI Hub by the end of the year, which is a huge win, and that's going to, over the course of 10 years, basically put funding from these companies into a fund that will be sort of like an insurance policy for the city so that if a disaster does occur, then those funds will get used to help with the cleanup. And it also incentivizes the companies to do earthquake retrofits because the more that they do that, the less that they have to pay into this risk bonding. And so that's really good. That's a great start. But I'm also looking at some cities in Washington that are doing really big climate adaptation studies and really getting a dollar amount for how much that is going to cost the city, and then splitting that among all of the known polluters in the city. So saying, okay, this is your yearly charge because we are going to have to adapt to rising rivers, to more extreme temperatures because of what you're polluting and what you're bringing into the air, and we as taxpayers do not want to pay for that. And so really looking at how can Portland get an estimate of that kind and split it among our known polluters so that we don't have to pay for moving our infrastructure, updating our infrastructure, moving out of the floodplains as our rivers rise.
And Lisa?
Yeah. The Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub is really an example of how our current form of government has failed us. Because anyone can drive by it, look at it, see, again, it's between a forest and a river, read a page about it, and see this is a huge problem. And no one has championed it on the city side. And that is going to be the responsibility of District 4 representatives. This is in District 4. It impacts our neighbors in Linton, as well as the whole city. But this is our problem. So this really needs to be championed by District 4 representatives taking the lead on this. Risk bonding has already been mentioned several times, and I completely agree with moving forward with that. The city has control of land use, so I think revoking Zenith's land use, its lux, which I'm blanking on what
land
that means
use
now.
Compatibility statement.
Thank you very much. Is something we can do. You know, that was awarded against the will of the community behind closed doors. It was not only an issue of bad for our climate, bad for our emergency preparedness, but also just bad for democracy. And so that's something we can do as well.
I'm curious, the process that the Department of Environmental Quality is going through right now to determine whether they're going to give Zenith the clean air permit that they desire, and the process is actually starting next week. Some of us were hoping it would get kicked back till next year. If it turns out the DEQ gives Zenith the clean air permit so they can continue, I mean, they've been operating without it for 7 years, but this would make them legal again. Is there anything that you see that the city could do to shut Zenith down at that point?
I mean, I think it's still possible to come at it from the land use angle. That is something that the city has control over. And as Chad mentioned, yeah, we have a responsibility to put this on the legislative agenda when we go to the state and make sure that this is top of the list for we need to address this.
Okay, well, I'm sitting here fantasizing you guys all being on the city council. Everything's great. What will you do, or what's the plan if Renee Gonzalez is elected mayor? Chad?
I think that we will take comfort in the fact that we have a weak mayor system and that the power will really reside primarily in the council president.
But he has the ability to appoint the city administrator, who's going to be a very important person.
That's true. We have the power of the budget, though. And so we control the budget. And with a supermajority, we can also recall someone. That said, you know, the thing to do would be to try to find things that we can agree on and try to pull him over towards evidence-based policy. I will say that I sit down with everybody, because when Portland has really thrived, we've been able to keep the business community from acting against its own long-term interest. And so, you know, helping kind of preach the gospel of enlightened self-interest can sometimes be helpful. And I know that the business community has its own suspicions about him. They are tired of the chaos and really just a lack of accomplishments. So I think that we might actually have some surprising sources of support.
Actually, Andrew, answer this, and then another question just popped into my head, but.
Yeah, I think it's definitely an interesting question, and it's definitely foremost on a lot of people's minds, and especially as Renee has been endorsing a lot of city council candidates, it's a very interesting game right now. But I think, one, we have a lot of really good mayoral candidates in the race. A lot of really interesting people have joined. And then also, if he were to get elected, yeah, I kind of would take Chad's stance in terms of, like, we got to collaborate with everybody. You're not going to agree with everybody. And so how do we become unlikely allies? How do we find things in common? How do we approach with, you know, evidence, with here's the studies that have been done, here's the risk factors, here's the lives that would be at risk, I think, especially with climate issues, and really trying to push change on that level. And then also, I think that one thing I've been looking into a lot is zoning reform. And I think that that is very much a bipartisan issue that a lot of people can get on board with, because right now in our residential zones, you can only build up to a quadplex, which is obviously driving some of our housing costs. And so I think zoning reform is very overdue. Portland has made some changes with abolishing its parking minimums and with abolishing single family home zones, but there's a lot more we can do. And I think that we can do that with broad support from the city and from its citizens.
And Lisa?
Yeah, I think the number one thing that council needs to be focused on is protecting charter reform in that case. I think we have seen that Commissioner Gonzalez is not invested in making our new form of government work. He's proposed many amendments to charter reform, to the recommendations from the transition committee. And so council will need to be watched very closely. You know, we're going to be forming this new idea in practice. And so we need to make sure that we're protecting what voters asked for when they requested charter reform. We do get to confirm the city administrator, so it's not a carte blanche appointment. So just making sure that we're working closely together, again, to protect the reforms that voters requested. And it's meant to be a check on power, so playing that role.
Well, we just have a few minutes left, and I kind of, while I'm on this Renee Gonzalez role, I want to talk about two other city issues that are really important that he really did everything he could to dismantle. One is the Portland Street Response, and the other one is the Portland Clean Energy Fund. So start with Chad. How do you see that you would protect both of those institutions, even if Renee Gonzalez is mayor?
Yeah. I support expanding Portland Street Response so that it's 24/7. And I think that when we talk to the public about this, the public, Renee is very far outside the mainstream. And again, I've knocked on so many doors, and I knock on Republican doors, Democratic doors, Libertarian doors, it doesn't matter. And everyone is in favor of Portland Street Response. So this is a very fringe position to think that, mainly because it's anti-police. Police want to be out there stopping violent crime and property theft. When PSR is out there, there's a drop in the number of calls the police department gets. So they're not inundated and just choked by all these wellness checks and things that they are not the best responder for. When you explain things like that to people, regardless of where they are in the ideological spectrum, you get this groundswell of support for PSR. For PSF, again, I think celebrating the things that it's doing is really good. Talking about all of the aspects, it's helping create a more equitable workforce. It's helping make sure that all of these jobs that are coming for the green economy that we all participate in it. Because historically in these transitions, the people that get left out are black and brown people and folks that have been historically excluded. So making sure that we have opportunities for pre-apprenticeship programs and apprenticeship programs, making sure that we have strong project labor agreements on some of these PCF projects is really important. And that it's not just rated to fill budget gaps. I think that keeping PCF primarily focused on community organizations is good. There are some things where the government does something better, for instance, transportation. And I can see PBOT being a beneficiary of some PCF funds, but it shouldn't just be used to backfill any old project.
And Andra?
Yeah, so I've been advocating for the Portland Clean Energy Fund as part of my work with the environmental groups, and it's been really important to me. And so, and I also was on that tour with Chad and Lisa of the PSF sites and all of the work that's being done there. And what I think that would really help PSF to gain more public support is for those projects to be more visible. And I think in general, and Lisa mentioned that they're hiring an outreach person at the city, which is great because in my experience of trying to get involved with the city and trying to participate, it's really difficult. And you have to sign up for like 50 different newsletters, and there's not really a centralized social media account, and there's not information getting out to the public very well. And so really addressing those gaps in communication with the public, I think, can help us with support. And as Portlanders, we voted for the Portland Clean Energy Fund. And so that's powerful. And that carries a lot of weight. And our elected officials can't easily do away with that. So I think leaning on that power is really important. And then getting word out about what's being done already. And then super big in support of Portland Street Response. I just personally coming from this, I do a lot of mutual aid work in the unhoused community, and so many of them have honestly quite horrific, traumatic stories of experiences with the police, to the point that people will immediately start having a triggered mental health response, a panic attack, just by seeing a police officer's vest. And so when we talk about not having a one-size-fits-all solution, we need to understand some people are going to be triggered even by the uniform. And so being able to send out Portland Street Response, who is a trauma-informed organization, and they can have an empathetic approach, is going to be really important. And right now, Portland Street Response cannot operate during the evening, which is a time where a lot of people are in crisis. And so I really think that we need to use all levers to make sure that we are able to really reach our constituents.
And Lisa.
Yeah. Both PSF and Portland Street Response, as been mentioned, are very popular. So if the city council is truly representing community concerns, I'm not really worried about those going forward. We will have to protect them. But I'll focus on Portland Street Response because I spent a lot of my time at the city working on supporting and advancing non-traditional responders. And I got to participate in a government Harvard Government Performance Lab cohort on alternative 911 emergency response with 14 other cities around the nation that are launching and implementing Portland Street Response-like programs. And I am just so convinced that this is the public safety of the future. It doesn't take away from the value of our police, our fire, or our 911. This is an added tool, and gold standard cities around the country are establishing co-equal bureaus with leadership for these types of mental health responders, that it's at the same level of police and fire. And that's what I think the way of the future is. So we just need to commit and invest, because every city is going to be there in 20 years.
Well, Lisa, Andra, and Chad, it's great talking with you. It's really nice to know that people like you, and actually people that are you, are running for city council. Things are really, feels like there's a change in the air here in Portland. So thanks very much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having us.
And you've been listening to Running on Air, produced at KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. I've been here with Chad Likens, Lisa Friedman, and Andra Voltaveen. These are all candidates from District 4. You can find all of the episodes of Running on Air on the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm/runningonair. Episodes are also available wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you to all the KBOO volunteers who helped to make this happen. Our engineers are Bob Davis and Althea Billings. Our producer is Althea Billings, and our editor is Eric Leuschner. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening.
This episode of Running on Air was a special rebroadcast that was taped live in the KBOO studio on Thursday, September 9th, 2024. Dates and events mentioned by these candidates may have already occurred. You can study up for this election by listening to all of our episodes of Running on Air on the KBOO website, kboo.fm, or you can listen wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for being with us.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Tune in.